huge welcome to all of you. Before we do our first practice and chant, I want to start by thanking you all for both the sharings that have been coming in on the listserv. Someone wrote that every email on the listserv is a teaching, and I want to echo that. It's really quite an extraordinary satsang that we're having on karma and liberation from karma. And I want to take this a little bit further with a quote from a great Buddhist master, Shantideva. You know, the Buddhists, I think perhaps because a lot of the old Buddhist practices involved people who lived in monasteries. And you know how it is in monasteries, people don't have to earn a living, so they have lots of time to contemplate, and which means that they have lots of time to write texts. So there's an enormous amount of knowledge, wisdom, understanding about karma and practice that comes through the Buddhist tradition, as there is that comes through the Hindu monastic traditions. One of the great masters of transforming the mind and ultimately transforming karma was Shantideva, and who wrote, "Aspiration is the root of every virtue. Thus the Mighty One, the Buddha, has said, an aspiration's root in turn is constant meditation on the fruits of actions." So in other words, what gives us the motivation, the deep desire for practice, for transformation, is our recognition of the fruits of action. And this is actually the reason why the doctrine of karma has been such a major part of both the Hindu and Buddhist traditions, and also very much a part of the of Orthodox Jewish tradition, because it's when we understand not just the power of action to create, let's say, positive and negative consequences in our lives, but also the power of thought and action to change our experience of our life, it's then that the intensity of our aspiration or our intention begins to grow. So someone asked this question when I asked for questions. A lot of really great questions came in, and one of them was about intention and whether it's enough to just have a strong intention for something to come about. And one thing is true, which is that our intention to liberate ourselves and others, our intention to know the truth, our intention to evolve our own consciousness and to evolve consciousness in general has enormous transformative power, perhaps the greatest transformative power of any intention we can come up with, and other intentions are equally significant. But the intentions that we form by really deeply recognizing the effect that our thoughts and actions have had on our lives, we'll say more about that, and also recognizing the power of thought and action in the present moment to change our destiny, to turn the karmic circumstances of our lives into liberating destiny. When we realize that, that's when our intentions really begin to become strong. So we can only understand why intention and aspiration are powerful when we understand the power of karma. And the deep reason to study it is to recognize these two basic truths, which I'm repeating a few times. This is our mantra, by the way, for this class. The first, that actions have consequences. And second, that there's no power like right action in the present moment. There's no power like right action in the present moment. The sage Vasishtha has a wonderful paragraph in the Yoga Vasishtha, which is a great text of Vedanta. He says, destiny, that is to say past karma, and present action are like two rams battling it out for supremacy. The strongest one wins. And there's no power like the effort that you make in the present moment. There's no power like the effort that you make in the present moment. This is really the great good news of karma. So we'll begin with an aspiration. I'll say it, and you can say it over to yourself, or you can just listen. Then we'll chant our opening mantras, and we'll do a very short a karma, what I call a karma burning practice or a karma clearing meditation practice, and then we'll go a little bit further in our understanding of karma. So here's the aspiration. Close your eyes. That's not the aspiration, that's the preparation. Close your eyes. Let the breath bring you into an upright and comfortable posture. Inhaling, allow the sitting bones to become grounded. Exhaling, let the inner body rise up through the crown. Let your shoulder blades come onto your back and the chest open. And in this position, lifted and also receptive, we'll begin. So here's the aspiration. May what we are about to do yield beneficial results. May it give us the power to be of real benefit to others. May it help us to overcome our delusions and wake us up from our blindness. May it clear away the obstacles on our path. May it bring love and propel us towards enlightenment. And now we'll chant the mantras, invoking the grace of that underlying auspiciousness that's the source of life. With the inhalation, move your head, turn your head to the left with the thought, any energy which I have left among the places and people where I've been today, may it come back to me. any energy from others, you say as you turn your head to the right with the exhalation, any energy from others that I've taken on, may it go back to them. So inhaling, you turn your head to the left with the thought, any energy that I've left in the situations and the people with whom I've interacted today, may it come back to me. And with the exhalation, you turn your head to the right and you think, any energy that I've taken on from other people or places, may it go back to them. Inhaling to the left, taking back the energy that has been scattered among the people and places of your bay. Exhaling to the right, sending back the energy that you may have taken on from others. And with the next inhalation, let your head return to its normal position. And just for a moment, inhale into the heart with the thought, Namah Shivaya. Exhale, feeling the inner space that the mantra creates. Inhale into the heart with Namah Shivaya. Let's spend a moment injecting this liberating thought into our being. And you can open your eyes. We'll be doing a few practices in the course of this class. And we'll also be doing some looking into the questions that you've asked and some of the deeper teachings about karma. I want to start by saying something about the cord cutting practice, which I see that has been very, very powerful for many people, has brought some of you a sense of self-understanding and contemplation, some of you a sense of freedom, of, you know, kind of immediate freedom. Some of you a recognition that there's actually quite a lot of cords. And for others, a kind of beneficial, what I call a beneficial upheaval, a kind of stirring of the soul, that's inevitable and actually very, very important when we begin to work with some of these buried issues. They come out in our dreams. They come out in realizations and recognitions of patterns in our lives. And they really do begin to bring about change from the very depths of our soul. One person wrote in that when she cut the cords between her and her father, whom she acts as a caretaker for, that he looked scared in her vision, not in his physical body. And she asked it whether she was creating more karma by doing this. And what I want to say very strongly is that, in fact, on the contrary, you're not only not creating more karma, you're also not hurting the other person. Although very often the the sense of being tied or obligated or in some way codependent on another person, with another person, will make that person, when they appear in your contemplation, your meditation, kind of mirror the feeling that you have. So it's very interesting in this cord-cutting process to just notice what scares you, what hesitations you have, because they are all kind of indications of the particular quality of enmeshment and the quality of and the reasons why we often tend to stay enmeshed in relationships. Those energetic threads are actually the energetic threads of what is these days called codependence. And of course, it's very easy to mistake codependence for something more noble, to mistake codependence for love. One of the amazing things that happens when we start cutting cords is that we begin to recognize what the actual freedom of love feels like, and also what our genuine obligations are in a relationship, because for sure there are relationships in which we have very genuine obligations. And as someone brought up, often these are obligations to family members or to friends, and there are many obligations to ourselves, which we also begin to recognize when we start cutting the cords of enmeshment. Since the roots of karma are subtle, are actually energetic, the truth is that the place where we have the most power to make change is in the subtle realm, in the imaginal realm, as the Jungians say, which is why these kinds of practices, the cutting cords and talking to someone in an imaginal way, offering them flowers, why these practices, which are actually shamanic practices, they fall under the heading of practices that we call shamanic, because they work with this subtle body and with subtle relationship. In other words, they're about that liminal place between absolute consciousness and the physical world, the place, in other words, where real transformation is able to happen. And it's because of the power of the imaginal realm. Imaginal doesn't mean imaginary. It means the place of images, the place of subtle images. It's why setting intentions is so powerful. And it's why prayers are powerful. Someone asked the question about whether prayers make a difference. Of course they do. It's not that they always change things in the physical realm. Sometimes once something has hit the physical, it's very hard to change it. But what cord cutting and prayers will do is mitigate, change our reactions, shift the overall energetic situation, and very often they'll shift the physical effects. So cord cutting is a liberating action, and if you're feeling aversion or fear when you do it, what you need to do is notice the feelings and then breathe them out. Understand that the feelings themselves are evidence of the karmic patterns. And then you might simply ask, with sincere intention, may these feelings of fear or anger be resolved. May the relationship be resolved. May my actions bring more love. And it's also true that if you are very enmeshed with someone, and especially if you live with them, this was another question, you may have to regularly disentangle the cords. I think we all have certain relationships, at least those of us who have families and or very close relationships with one or two other people. We often find that the tendency to cord each other, as it's called, comes up, and we just have to liberate ourselves from the stickiness from time to time. We begin to notice when we're feeling corded or when we're cording. By the sense that comes over us of kind of, might be neediness, it might be a feeling of sort of being pushed to the limit. It may be a sense of kind of guilty obligation. These are all expressions of energetic cords, let's say codependent energetic cords that are inappropriately binding us. And they're very different from the clear feelings that we have of wanting to help somebody, of loving somebody. So the thing is, it's the charge, the stickiness in relationships and in events that happen around them that keep us stuck. It's not the relationships themselves. It's not the events themselves. It's really the karma is in the emotional charge. The fact is, of course, as I think most of us know, every relationship in our life is there for a reason. And as several people have brought up, there's nothing that occurs in our life, in the web of our life, which is not in some way karmic. But the relationships that affect us, the relationships that have charge for us, are the relationships in which there's something to work out. One teacher of my youth used to say that when you meet somebody and are drawn to them, it means that you have work to do with each other. And that work can be lovely, or it can be hard. But as long as there's still something that you have to do together, the relationship will be there in your life. And when there isn't, when that work is done, very often that person won't be in your life anymore, or they'll become more peripheral. And for people who are living living lives that are very much about spiritual growth, which of course we all are, but you know, some people seem to have signed on for a faster ride than most of those in the world. For many people who signed on for a particular way of living, relationships will come and go in kind of dramatic ways sometimes. But normally, when it's leaving your life because the karma is done, it will feel as if it just kind of slipped away or dissolved. In other words, there won't be that charge that comes when you feel unfinished business with somebody. And a lot of the karmic involvements that we have, obviously, are with family members. And a blood family can be a vortex of people who incarnate together to work out certain things. For other families, other people, the family is not so important, you know, except in the sense that, that we're born into a certain family in order to have certain childhood experiences, to receive certain genetic or ancestral tendencies. And it may be that people not in our blood family have a kind of deeper karmic connection with us. Although it's said that we've been karmically connected to virtually everyone in the world at one time or another, you know, reality is sometimes compared to this extraordinary web of interconnections that in the Indian scriptures is called Indra's net, the net of causality that connects absolutely everyone and everything in this universe. So we're connected to everyone, but there are certain groups of souls that constitute karmic tribes. We incarnate with them again and again in different relationships. It's often with them that we learn our deep lessons. Our teachers come from members of our karmic tribe. Otherwise we're not drawn to them. You know, if you're in a teaching situation with somebody, it's because there's a connection. If you're obviously in a romantic relationship with someone, it's because there's a connection. If you're working with somebody, it's because there's a connection. Some of them may be deep, deep connections. Some of them may be temporary. But the presence of people, important people in our life, is often an indication that we are part of a karmic tribe. What in the Hasidic tradition they call a soul group. And often in these relationships, as we said last week, there's a debt. Clearly, we find it in family relationships. being a parent is a big deal, and being someone's child is a big deal. There's a, in the Tibetan tradition, they say that the way we come into bodies is that we're, you know, we're kind of moving around in the subtle realm in the bardos, and we're drawn to a particular couple at a moment when they're making love, and we're attracted. It's so interesting that the texts say this. We're attracted to the opposite sex parents. Although I guess if our tendency is homosexual, we'll be attracted to the same sex parent. But there's actually a sexual attraction that occurs to this couple, to one member of this couple, and it's that attraction that draws us into the body that comes together from the sperm and egg of this couple. So we're literally drawn into a body by our relationship to our parents, or to one of our parents. And, you know, very often in our lives, it is one particular parent who is the karmic glue. And it's also possible that a parent-child or siblings or people in a family or friends or lovers or partners are repeating a pattern that's gone on for lifetimes. And this is one of the reasons why the cord-cutting practice is so significant. I first got interested in the cord-cutting practice with a student of mine who had an intensely entangled relationship with her father, which there was a lot of love and a lot of hurt, as, you know, there is often for us with parents. When her parents got divorced when she was 17, and just as she was going to college, and her father refused to contribute anything to her college fees, even though he could afford it, and even though he had supported her brothers through college. And over the course of their lives together, he, even though they were very emotionally attached to each other, he never gave her any sort of worldly support. And years later, she had a series of meditation experiences in which she saw glimpses of her past life with her father, and she saw that in several lives they'd been married, and it had been in situations in societies in which the relationships between men and women were very much male-dominated, and in each situation he had deprived her financially, once leaving her for another woman, leaving her penniless, once leaving all his money to his sons, and leaving her with no provisions for her future when he died. And in their current life, they were playing out the old pattern. And when she began cutting the cords, dialoguing with him in this on the subtle level, and she began to actually be able to talk to her father in such a way that by the time he died, which was 2 years later, they actually both had looked at the situation, and it seemed to her, at least, that they had resolved this piece of old karma in such a way that whether they found each other in another life or not, they wouldn't be looking through, they wouldn't be acting out this pattern. So this is really one of the reasons why becoming conscious, bringing consciousness to our relationships in this way, looking at the karmic patterns in this way, can be so incredibly liberating. The karmic binds that we live in are really the result of unconsciousness. They're really the result of unconsciousness, of a kind of blindness to the thoughts and reasons for our actions. And this doesn't mean that we need to analyze every single karmic pattern that we have. I'll say more about that in a minute. Because ultimately, the karmic bondage that we experience is the result of identifying ourselves with the false self, with the separated ego, with our blind compulsions to grasp experiences that feel good to the ego and to push away experiences that don't feel good to the ego. All of our binding karmas, the positive ones as well as the negative ones, are the result of this feeling of grasping at an identity, at a separate identity. And as long as we identify ourselves as a particular person, as actions and thoughts stick to us, they cling to us, and they create lives in which they need to be re-experienced. My guru used to say that our accumulated negative qualities are an iron chain, while our accumulated positive karmas are a golden chain. But they're both chains, because in both cases we have to be reborn to experience the fruits of them. And I'm not saying that we necessarily are in a situation where we want to never be reborn. Sometimes we do want to be reborn for various reasons. But if we are going to be reborn, at least for me, we'd like to be reborn out of choice in a state of freedom. And the point is that too much good karma can be difficult in its own way as too much negative karma. I'm actually thinking of two people that I know very well. One was a very famous and very difficult political figure who came to see my guru in the early 80s at a time when he was in a lot of trouble. And he's a very charismatic guy. I had a certain amount of sympathy for him, and he came a lot to my guru, and he went to see a Vedic astrologer who was a devotee of my guru, and whom people often used to see, you know, to help them understand certain karmic pickles. And I asked the astrologer afterwards whether his relationship with the guru could keep him from having to pay the penalty for certain actions that he was in a lot of trouble for. And the astrologer said, well, there are certain chains of negative karmas that are so intense that they simply have to be played out, and often they will continue to keep you spinning in a certain way. He said, but what the connection with spiritual practice can do is help you see through it and start to do the good actions that will change it. The good karma trap is illustrated by a woman I know who has actually more gifts than just about anyone I've ever met. She was born wealthy. She's an enormously talented painter. She has a great husband. She's a close friend of several important and very profound spiritual teachers, and she has done spiritual practice for 25 years, but she's never been able to get serious about it. You know, her practice is really kind of part of her recreation. It's never really transformed her. She's pretty much the same person with the same issues that she was when I first knew her, and in a certain sense, she's bound by the chain of her incredibly good karma. It's not that having good karma is necessarily going to be a spiritual obstacle, not at all. But it's certain kinds of accumulated good actions which are spiritually fruitful, and the ones that are fruitful in that way are the ones that we've done with an intention, with a transformative intention, with an unselfish intention, that we've done with the intention of awakening. The accumulation of these kinds of actions, of actions performed with an aspiration towards the evolution of consciousness in whatever way we define that, which create in us what in Buddhism is called an awakened mind. The Sanskrit is bodhicitta. Bodhi meaning awakened or enlightened, and citta meaning mind stuff. It's these accumulated good actions that create in us the platform in which we actually are deeply motivated to ground ourselves in the truth and to help other people discover and live in the truth. So, from a spiritual point of view, the real sign that our good actions are ripening, so to speak, and I'm sorry to use these terms, good and bad, it's our positively motivated or negatively motivated actions. The real sign that our positively motivated actions are ripening is not that everything starts getting easy for us in our worldly life, although for sure that happens sometimes for some people. It's when we begin to have a sharp, powerful interest in practice, in changing our karmic patterns, in being in kindness, when we begin to actually look into ourselves in a serious way. These are signs these are signs of the kind of positive karma that liberates us, and it's the most important kind of karma, because it's this kind of mind which will change our life. So our ability to help others and ourselves is one of the effects of our positive karmas from the past. But, and this is the interesting thing, another effect of our positive karmas from the past is the ability to recognize when we can't help and to use our mind to wish well, even if there's nothing we can do in the physical plane. The mere fact that we're interested in spirituality and we're willing to look into our own minds and change our moment by moment, change our fear into courage, change our hatred into love, change our boredom into interest. In other words, the mere fact that we're willing to work with our mind is a sign of great karmic progress. There's a wonderful statement of the Dalai Lama, which I'm sure many of you know, that kindness is actually one of the deeper forms of selfishness, because when you're kind or when you perform good action, you're actually ensuring that your life is going to be happy in the future, or at least better, or at least helpful to others. So the reason for this, we're going to do a practice in a moment that will begin to hopefully totally loosen the roots of your binding karmas, or at least make a little dent in them. So again, the root of binding karma is our basic selfishness in the sense of considering ourselves the most important entity in the cosmos. So that deep inborn desire, that deep inborn feeling of what Carlos Castaneda's teacher Don Juan called self-importance, to gain advantage for ourselves at the expense of others, or advantage for ourselves and the people close to us, the people we identify with. Ultimately, it's the sense of being a separate self. And as long as we have that belief in a separate self, our actions will be motivated by that belief. But the moment we genuinely realize what we are, the moment we recognize our largeness, the moment we recognize our nature as awareness, the moment we recognize our nature as love, you know, this kind of realization happens in different ways, in different flavors. And especially when we begin to understand in a felt way, in a visceral way, that our true self is not different than the true self of others, that realization burns the backlog of our karmas. So it's actually the capacity for self-knowing that's the greatest, and for self-expansion, that's the greatest antidote to karmic bondage. Shankaracharya, the great Vedantic sage, says, just as a single spark can burn down an ancient forest, the fire of realization of your true nature burns the accumulated karmas of countless lifetimes. So we're going to do a practice that's a way of moving into interconnectedness. And you can stretch for a moment if you need to do that, if you'd like to do that. And then you can take a seat. And again, we'll do the posture alignment, breathing in and letting the base of the posture ground get heavy, sink into the floor. Exhaling, feeling the inner body rising up through the crown of the head. inhaling and allowing the chest to lift and open and the shoulder blades to release onto the back. Exhaling, feeling the lift all the way from the base of the spine up through the crown so that the head rises from within towards the ceiling, the crown rising towards the ceiling, the chin tucking slightly. And the practice we're going to do now is actually a practice for loosening the sense of separateness that our body boundaries, our skin-encapsulated bodies, create for us. What we'll be doing is using the breath to connect us to the area around our body. As you do it, you'll inhale first with the sense that you breathe in first the area in front of you. And I'm just going to explain it to you and then I'll guide you in it. So the first stage is to breathe in the area in front of you, having the feeling that the whole area in front of you is flowing into your body with the inhalation, and then with the exhalation you let it flow out. And we'll do that a few times, and then we'll do the same thing with the area behind us, breathing it in, and then exhaling, breathing it back out. We'll breathe in the area to the right side, and then breathe it back out, then to the left side, then the area below the body, and then finally the area above the body. And as we do that, you'll see it has a very interesting effect on the way you experience your body and the way you experience your surroundings. I would say that what you might find is that your sense of the surrounding area is just a foot or two, or you might find that it's huge. In other words, you might find at a certain point that you're actually breathing in and out the city or the world, but just let it happen. Just let it happen. Let yourself play with the practice and notice what happens to your sense of space. Space is one of the metaphors for pure awareness, for the true self. And the breath is one of the engines, it's the great vehicle through which we connect body, mind, and our own spaciousness. So you can close your eyes. Let your attention flow to the breath. And breathing in, have the feeling that you're breathing in the entire area in front of you. Perhaps just the space in front of you. Perhaps you might feel that you're breathing in the entire room. Don't force it, just notice what it feels like to breathe in the space in front of you, in front of your body, and then to breathe it out with the exhalation. And continue to do this. Breathing in the space in front of you, breathing it out with the exhalation. Thoughts arise. Notice the thought and breathe it out. The next inhalation. Have the sense that you're breathing in the space, the area at your back. And with the exhalation, breathe it back out. Feel that the space behind you is flowing into you through the pores of your back. As if your back is porous. again, having the sense that the boundaries of your body, the skin of your body, is porous. Allow yourself to breathe in through your pores, space to your right. Your next inhalation, feel that you're breathing in the space below you, which may include the floor, foundations of the building. Breathe it in through the pores beneath your seat. Your head, imagining that the entire space above you flows into your body through the pores. And that with the exhalation, it flows back out. Now see if you can, with the next inhalation, have the sense that you're breathing in the entire space around you, before you, behind you, to each side, above and below. Your body is open. You're able to inhale and exhale the entire area around your body. open your eyes. And if you like, you can continue the practice. Actually, three main factors in antidoting what we can call karmic bondage. First, the spiritual practices of recognizing our real nature as awareness and recognizing our interconnectedness, of which we just did one. Secondly, the practices that clear the mind so that we become capable of recognizing our own fundamental clarity. And these mind-clearing practices, one of them is mantra, which has other effects as well. Another is chanting. many of the analytical practices of study and understanding fall into this category. And third, and very important, practices that tend to mitigate our basic selfishness, which is to say, practices of karma yoga, of service, of exchanging ourself for others, which is something that we'll be practicing this week. We'll actually be doing all of these in the course of this class, because why study karma if we're not also going to study the ways we liberate ourselves in karma? but in order for any of these practices to be effective, of course, we also need to train ourselves to become aware of our habitual ways of reacting and thinking and notice when they trip them up. This is why it's important to look at karmic patterns, and it's not so we'll get depressed or elated. Certainly not so we'll get confused, so that we can begin to understand a little bit about what we're working with in this lifetime. And, you know, as a couple of people have said, certain modalities, like the Enneagram, like some of the ways of analyzing the way we, you know, our makeup as human beings, Vedic astrology, which is incredibly good at predicting outcomes, especially if the astrologer is, is not stuck in determinism. And I say this because the more evolved the consciousness is of a particular person, the more psychologically acute they are, the more the karmic patterns will tend to work themselves out in the mind, and not necessarily have to come into physical manifestation. It's one of the very important gifts of modernity is that we actually have learned how to work with karmic tendencies on a subtle level before they manifest physically. So, in the old days, when astrologers were very, very skilled at looking at karmic events, aspects of Prarabdha karma in the chart, they would see, for example, a configuration in somebody's chart that showed a serious illness or an accident, and very often they would see that this person would die from the illness or accident, because conditions at that time were such that if you got certain diseases, you didn't survive, or if you fell and hurt yourself in certain ways, there was no way of saving your life. So just on that level, many of the configurations that show up in an astrology chart that look quite dire are much less dire than they would have been 200 years ago or 50 years ago even. At the same time, the Vedic astrology science is extremely accurate predictively, and I'm thinking of a a story I just can't help telling you, which was told to me by a man I know in India, who'd gotten very sick. He had one of those strange diseases that nobody could really diagnose. It went on for a couple of years, and he did a lot of work with it. He worked with his diet. He did supplements. He went to doctors. He went to famous Ayurvedic specialists, and none of the antidotes really helped. And then about 2 years after he'd first gotten this disease, he had a dream in which he was told that there's a certain Ayurvedic herb that would cure the disease. So he went to an Ayurvedic practitioner, and he got the herb, he took it, and within a couple of weeks he was fine. And he went back to the Ayurvedic practitioner. Really skilled Ayurvedic practitioners in India are often quite skilled at subtle understanding, subtle diagnosis as well. And he asked the practitioner why it was that he'd only found out about this herb at that moment, when in fact it was what had cured him. And the Vaidya, which is what they're called, the Ayurvedic doctor, said it was a matter of timing. In other words, you had the karma to have this illness for a certain amount of time, and when it was time, the cure came. So there's something about being able to recognize the way time works in your life, in your destiny, that can actually be very helpful. If you understand it in the right way, not in a fatalistic way, but to recognize that certain periods of your life will demand effort from you that will not necessarily bear fruit at that time, that it might actually take some time for the effects of your effort to bear fruit. And this is true in every aspect of your life. You know, for instance, when I first began doing spiritual practice, even though I was having many, many transformative experiences, I really had a I had a very hard time getting into deep meditation. And it actually took me a couple of years and quite a lot of serious practice. I meditated every day for an hour, and I did a lot of meditation repetition, a mantra repetition. And at some point, I guess about really 2 years after I started, my meditation began to go deep. And the reason I've come to see is because, for whatever reason, I had the kind of karmic tendencies which made it very hard for me to still my mind. And the practices that I did allowed the texture of my mind to shift so that I could go deep into meditation. And I've always thought that one of the reasons why I can work with students is because I really understand the ways in which our practice might be obstructed. And when I tell somebody, you know, if you keep doing it, it's actually going to change, and you're going to be able to have a deep effect of the practice. When I say that to somebody, I know it's true because it's been my experience. So it's actually our ability to have gone through certain difficult experiences that, as we know, that give us the wisdom, that give us the capacity to work on ourselves that we might not have experienced if our lives had been less challenging. So my point is really that all the practices we do to liberate ourselves and others will eventually bear fruit, because it's the way of karma to ripen. It's the way of karma to fructify, although it takes time. But the fortunate thing about the way the world works is that along with the effect of action, there's also the mysterious and imponderable and incredibly powerful force that in Sanskrit is called anugraha, which we translate as grace, which is the factor that comes into our life at various moments and just changes the entire picture. It's the factor actually that allows us to make quantum leaps. If we didn't have the grace factor in life, then our karmas, which are beginningless, would never be done, because it is actually impossible to exhaust all of our karmas. If you think about it, everything we do is creating new karmic situations. So the secret of freedom, the secret of liberation, is this factor that's outside the law of karma, that's actually part of the what in Sanskrit is called the lila, or the the playful aspect of the divine. Someone asked why, when there's only consciousness in the universe and when everything is one, why we have to go through all this differentiation and action and suffering. It's one of the big questions that we often ask when we begin spiritual practice. What the Indian traditions say, I mean, there are different answers to this question in different traditions, but what it basically comes down to, what the Indian traditions say, Hinduism and Buddhism, is that this cosmic display, this life, is the lila. Lila means sport. It means game. It's the playful creation of consciousness, which simply for the sake of love, for the sake of play, just manifests this amazing game that it plays with itself in all these different forms. So the laws of karma are the rules that make the game work. But there's this deeper factor which can change the game in a moment. And it's that factor which will ultimately free you. So we have these experiences that something will happen in life. We'll have an accident or we'll have a meeting with somebody, and suddenly we realize that everything has changed. Or we go along, you know, trying to learn a language, or trying to go deep into meditation, or trying to write a book and feeling completely stymied. And then there being a moment when there's a leap, when there's a quantum leap, when there's a breakthrough, when there's a shift. And often the experience is one of an actual evolutionary leap. The evolutionary leap that takes place inside our being, so that at one moment, at one, you know, 1 minute, we're all burdened and weirded out in all the ways that we, you know, we're used to being. And then the next day, or in the next moment, we're suddenly lighter. We're free. We're free of certain behaviors, certain limitations that we might not even have realized that we had. And this evolutionary leap, this shift, you know, this big shift, is not something that comes about just through our effort, just through our karma. The paradox is that the effort is necessary. But we really need that power of eros, that power of grace, that power of the transformative shakti to make those very difficult karmic bonds go away. And actually, part of what this course and the transformative vortex that we're in is really about is for all of us to really open ourselves to that transformative power which will tend to operate through a situation like this. So we do our actions, we do our inner work, and in the process we receive a very, very powerful infusion of grace, which makes stuff happen. So the Yoga Vashista says, self-effort and karma are like two rams battling for supremacy. The strongest one wins, but nothing is stronger than right action in the present moment. He could also have said, right action in the present moment gets its power through grace, through that tendency of the divine to want to get behind our liberating actions and really become the wind beneath our wings. So, just for a moment now, let's just return to the breathing process. inhaling, have a sense that you're breathing in the area, the energy around your body, breathing it in through your pores, just gently loosening the boundaries, the sense of being encased within the body. And then exhaling, you let it flow out through your pores. I want to answer a couple of questions, a couple of the questions that came in. And then I want to say a little bit about specific karmas and their antidotes. One of the questions that came up a couple of times was about our responsibility to help family members and whether there's anything that we can do for family members who are having a hard time. My experience has been that there are times when our intervention or help is crucial and effective, and there are other times when there's nothing we can do. And the only thing we can really do is try, is do what we can, and do it as an offering. In other words, do it with a very strong sense of having cut the cords that make us feel enmeshed with the family member, so that the action that we make to help them is actually done without getting us more enmeshed with them. And it's also very important to realize when what you do can't help them for whatever reason. As we know, sometimes we feel that our spiritual practice should be of help to our relatives who don't do spiritual practice. And I've heard from several of my friends who've lost parents in the last year. Many of my friends and I, myself, have lost parents in the last year. A couple of my friends who were actually with their parents when they were dying spoke about how they would try to interest their parents in doing a practice, you know, because they would feel as though somehow their spiritual practice should be able to help their father or their mother understand what they have understood. And in most cases, their parent was just really not able to get into it at all. And what my friends would find was that what they would do is sit with their parent, hold their hands, and just love them. And that it was the emotional connection, the love that they sent towards them, which was actually helpful and comforting, rather than the particular intention or the idea that they should have an experience of a peaceful death, which in some cases apparently they didn't. So, in a certain sense, the way we help our family members is by loving them. Another question that came was whether we can take on another person's karma, and the answer is that whenever we're very close to somebody, we do, to a certain extent, share their karmas. A married couple definitely shares karma. In fact, at one time in India, it was believed that if a man married a woman with auspicious money karma, that he would be wealthy because of her karma, and that the opposite was also true. But it's a very different thing to deliberately take on another person's karma. There are certain beings who have that capacity to remove karmas from other people. It's one of the gifts that a sadguru, a realized master who holds what one of my friends calls the guru chip. You know, there's actually a set of capacities that people who have been chosen by their lineage to be traditional gurus often hold, and one of them is the capacity to take on their disciples' karmas and burn them up. My guru, Swami Mukta Sananda gave his blessings to many people and did indeed take on their karmas. And he told us once that when he gave certain kinds of programs or gave certain kinds of blessings, that an enormous chunk of that person's karma would come to him, and that he would then go to his meditation room, go into deep meditation, and burn it off by entering into the state of non-duality. Clearly, this is not something that everyone can do. And for that reason, it's not really possible for us to take on each other's karmas, even though we may sometimes wish that we could. The other thing I wanted to say a little bit about is the topic of what the traditional texts say about the effects of certain actions. And I want to quote a little bit from a text of Tibetan Buddhism, which is probably the most specific piece of writing that I've ever read about what actions create certain difficulties and what the antidotes are. You know, we're going to talk next week in quite a detailed way about antidotes, about the ways in which we actually transform specific karmas and transform our karmas in general. But there's this text that I mentioned. It's called The Wheel of Sharp Weapons. It's an intense title, and some of the teachings in it are pretty intense. So the text begins by explaining that the belief in a separate self is the source of all karmic bonds. And then it begins to talk about what it is that you do to yourself as a result of certain selfish actions. So, for example, it says that when your relationships don't last, that is when people you love leave you, it's because in the past you have tried to take away lovers from, you've tried to take away others' lovers or mates, or you've destroyed other people's friendships. And the way you clear that pattern, the text says, is to support the friendships of others, to be helpful to the relationships with others, to wish people well in their relationships. It's said that when you don't make progress in meditation, it's because in the past you've made your spiritual practice, you've disrespected your spiritual practice and haven't made it a priority in your life. So the way to make progress in meditation is to honor it, to give it respect, to actually understand that it's not only as important, but in many ways more important than your worldly activities. It's said that when people disrespect you, or when people are mean to you, it's because you've considered other people to be your inferiors. So it's not necessarily your harshness to others that is the problem. It's your sense of being superior to others that causes that, you know, causes a backlash. It's interesting, isn't it? These particular understandings. There's a whole lot of them. And when injuries and accidents, the text says, is the result of injuries and accidents to the bodies of others. And we have to understand that, you know, again, the ways that karmas bear fruit in this lifetime are not necessarily the result of things that we've done in this lifetime. They may come from other lifetimes, in fact, sometimes from far back lifetimes. Which is the reason why bad things happen to good people. But also, you know, when injuries and accidents happen, as we said earlier, they may have to do with environmental factors, not with our own actions. But, and this is the important thing, because it's one thing to understand why something happens, it's another thing to understand what we can do about it. So the way in which we antidote difficult karmas having to do with the body, diseases and injuries, is to help save the lives of others. And there's actually a whole ritual that people do in Tibet and India, where you purchase live fish or birds, you know, and this is easier to do in places like China and India and Mexico than it is in the United States and Canada. But there are ways in which we can do this kind of thing in this country, and then you set them free. In fact, any practice you do of saving the life of an animal or bird will help ensure your health. I'm not sure that that includes the kind of activism where you go to pet stores and set all the pets free, as PETA activists sometimes do. I'm not going to go so far as to say that that's necessarily a way of reclaiming your health. But it's also very interesting to consider what you can do to save the lives of other creatures. Something sometimes as simple as putting the spider on a Kleenex and ushering it out the window rather than letting the water come in and drown it. Another point that these texts make is that physical gracefulness is the result of speaking and thinking well of other people. So our harsh and critical speech and our harsh and critical thoughts is often mirrored in our face and bodies, and we may want to just kind of cultivate beauty by generosity in speech. And I think what we see is that in all of these things is that when we look at our lives, it's often said we don't really need to know what happened in the past specifically, because we can understand something of what's going on and of what our past actions have been by looking at our lives today. So, you know, if relationships are difficult for us now, what it probably means is that we need to make efforts, towards connecting or towards kindness or towards generosity in relationships, and that these will bear fruit in more ease in relationship in another life. But it could also mean that we've lived lives in the past of being isolated, of being monastics, of living lives in which our attention was very inward. So it's not necessarily that the situations of this life are the result of actions which were cruel or inauspicious, but it's also true that, as we've been saying, that if we are interested in changing the way we experience our life in the future, that right action in the present moment is more powerful than anything else. And I want to give you a practice. It's the practice that comes from the same tradition as the first statement of Shanti Deva's, and it's one that many of you may be familiar with. It's the practice of sending and taking, and it's a very powerful practice in Tantric Buddhism. And we're going to be doing it this week. I'll be sending you the instructions for it. But right now, if you'd like to move your body and stretch, I'm going to give you these instructions now. My experience of this practice, the Tibetan name for it is Tonglen, which we translate as sending and taking. My experience of this practice is that it's most powerful when I'm doing the practice with something in my life that is disturbing. Some of my most powerful practices with it have been when I was angry or sad or jealous. Because when there's a charge in an emotion, or when you're in a situation that feels difficult for you, there's a lot of power in the practice. So this is how it works. And I'm going to give it to you. There are different ways of doing it. I'm going to give it to you in the way I learned it from a teacher. teacher of Chagda Tulku Rinpoche's tradition, and it's a little bit different than the way it's done in for example, the way it's taught in Pema Chodron's books. So I'm going to teach it to you with a kind of combination of instructions. But here's the point I want to make to you. The popular version of Tonglen, the version of Tonglen that's often practiced, is that you breathe in with the intention of taking other people's difficulties into your own heart. The way that I've learned this practice and that I find is actually more constructive, and at least it's the way I'd like to teach it to you, is that when you breathe in other people's difficulties, you breathe them in through your heart and offer them to the spaciousness behind you, the place where your heart connects to the great heart. So what you're actually doing is using your own body as a vehicle through which other people's pain can be actually offered into that the great heart, the great spaciousness, which can transmute their pain. You're not taking it into your own body. You're taking it through your body and offering it on their behalf. And I'll explain to you in a moment how we're going to do it. I know some of you are familiar with it. But one of the deep purposes of the practice is that it actually does help you recognize that your own situation, your own anger, your own sadness, your own difficult situations are not just yours. They're not just personal. They're actually shared by human beings all over the world, by animals as well. And it begins to really open up your heart to the sense of oneness and compassion, to a very visceral sense of oneness and compassion. Sometimes the question is asked if we do this, because of course our normal way of dealing with painful experiences and painful emotions is to try and get rid of them. If doing this practice is going to cement these difficult experiences within you, and the answer is no, it doesn't. It has in fact the opposite effect. It frees you. So do the practice. Really let yourself do the practice and let yourself notice what the effect is. It's very, very powerful. And for me and for many, many other practitioners, it's literally radically transformative. It's one of the great transformative practices for inner karmic knots that there is. So the way it works is like this. We'll begin with thanks to Pema Chodron, by breathing in the qualities of heat, of a kind of a, if we want to work with the color, a kind of a dark, hot, red color. So you want to breathe in the sense of heat, of a kind of fiery, intense, dark red, and a feeling of agitation, whichever one of these related feelings you can connect to. So you breathe in heat, you know, dark red energy, agitation. You breathe it in through your heart and have the feeling that these feelings flow out of the back of your body and into the spaciousness behind you. And then from the spaciousness behind you, you feel that you exhale coolness, softness, and silvery light. It flows out through your heart and out into the space in front of you. So you're breathing in heat, intense, dark red energy, agitation, and you're breathing out softness, coolness and peace. Breathing it in through the heart and into the spaciousness of the great heart outside you, behind you. And then from the great heart, breathing back softness, peace, silvery light, back through your heart and into the world in front of your body. Now bring to mind an emotion or a situation in your life where you feel pain or difficulty. It might be grief. It might be irritation. It might be some situation in your life that feels stuck. It might be an emotional intense emotional situation with another person. So bring that, the first one that comes to mind, bring it into your mind and get in touch with the feeling sense of it. And then breathe that, the felt sense of that emotion or that situation, breathe it in through your heart and offer it into the great heart behind you. And then breathe out from the great heart with the sense that you're breathing out spaciousness, softness, and peace. So you're breathing that intense emotion into the heart, into the back heart, into the great heart. And from the great heart, you breathe back spaciousness, softness, and peace. And you let that flow through your heart and out into the world. And now you bring to mind another person, someone you know, or someone in the world that you tune into who's experiencing this same emotion, this same feeling. And you breathe that feeling in from that person. You breathe into the feeling that you're taking in their anger or their grief or their the intensity of their emotion or of their difficulty, and you're breathing it in through your heart and into the great heart behind you. And then from the great heart, you breathe out peace, love, softness, and spaciousness into that person. So with your inhalation, you're taking in the emotion to which you feel kin from that person, breathing it in through the heart and into the great heart behind you. With the exhalation, you're breathing out from the great heart the qualities of spaciousness, peacefulness, and love. Breathing it into that person. Don't think too much about it. Just let it happen. All over the world who are experiencing these emotions. People in situations in which they're deeply angry or grieving. Incredibly jealous. confused, in difficult relationships, whatever it is. And then breathe in with the feeling that you're taking in those emotions from people all over the world. And just let yourself recognize how many people there are who are having this feeling or this situation in greater or lesser degrees. And breathe in that feeling as it comes to you. Breathe it through your own heart and into the great heart that stretches out behind you. And from the great heart, breathe out the feeling of sweetness, of love, of peacefulness. Breathe it into all those beings who are suffering from that emotion or situation that you're suffering from. Breathe in their particular suffering through the heart, into the great heart behind you. And then allow the love and peace, spaciousness and softness of the great heart to flow through your heart and into all those people. You can feel this practice by breathing in the mantra, the Namah Shivaya, breathing it in through your heart and into the great heart behind you, and allowing the great heart to breathe the mantra back through your heart, with the feeling that you're breathing it out into the world, into the hearts, all those hearts that you've contacted. And I'm going to ask you to sit with this practice for a little while, and then to journal about it. And I'm going to ask you to practice it a few times this week and see if you can really let yourself feel your way into it. It's an enormously powerful and transformative way of understanding the universality of emotion, and recognizing the profound kinship that we have with other beings, and also of transforming the very personal way we attach to our own feelings and experiences. It's an incredible practice for recognizing that we are not really isolated beings, that what we experience is the universal human experience. And in that way, beginning to shift the grasping quality that keeps us bound in our karmas. And we'll continue with the Namah Shivaya meditation practice those of you who are sensing that it's important to keep on cutting cords, I'm really hoping that we can continue with these practices that we began this week, continue them during this time we have together. And I send you huge love and great thanks for entering into this sacred work, this sacred practice.